We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 38, Jane Austen in the Wizarding World. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will be talking with Dr. Beatrice Groves about the deep connections between the works of Jane Austen and the Harry Potter series. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions and cultural competency at Mount Carmel College and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Today, we're going to be talking about the Harry Potter series' many references to and conjunctures with Jane Austen's novels. And Emily, I have to say that Jane Austen was one of the very first authors that I became like a devoted fan of. In my early teen years, after I read Pride and Prejudice for the first time, it was one of those things that like it just made me a reader in a way, you know? And I think the thing I liked best was probably her narrative voice.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think is one of the things I also most appreciate about the Harry Potter novels, too.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things that you really lose with the films. And
yes.
I always tell people you should read the books for the narrative voice, which is it's so delightful.
It is.
So, Emily, my question for you today is a tough one. What would you say is your favorite Jane Austen book?
You know, yeah, it is a tough question. And I have read them all. I think I got a later start than you. I was caught up with the Brontes when I was in high school.
Ooh, yeah. I did them too for the angst.
I really loved the creepy, the hefty doses of creepy in their books. So I think Austen, I want to say it was my friend Tree Slysaught who is an avid, you know, an annual, she says every year at Christmas, she reads Pride and Prejudice, you know, just cause that's just what you do, you know? And so I think she got me reading Austen and I did read through all of them and I was going to try to like, you know, name a more obscure one or a less well-read, but I just have to say Pride and Prejudice is just so gratifying to read. It's you know, it is just such an enjoyable story and you know, I get caught up in it every single time I read it.
Emily, I said the same one.
Yeah.
I was like, it has to be Pride and Prejudice.
It just has to be. And you know, of course then there's the BBC adaptation of it.
There's a whole industry around it.
There is. And yeah, we went to, my family all went to a costumes exhibit from Jane Austen film adaptations recently in Cincinnati. It was super fun and just brought back a lot of really wonderful memories seeing those costumes, you know, in real life. And so I have to say Pride and Prejudice for the win. What about you?
Yeah. And to me, Pride and Prejudice wins because of Elizabeth Bennet.
Mostly. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I think that was just my teenage personality.
You know,
I totally identified with her. But I think that, you know, then you reread it when you're older and you're like, oh, no, I'm still there. but I also wanted to say, I was like, you know, if I think about something that's a little more off the beaten path, my second one would be Northanger Abbey. Believe it or not, it's like a confessional. I confess, I love Northanger Abbey.
Yeah.
It's just so much fun. And I love the genre parody with Gothic because I think it's so clever And I like Gothic like Catherine Morland does in the books. Like, I like Gothic too, like you were saying with the Brontes and all that. But, and even, you know, more, I like the Anne Radcliffe and all that. But also, I find it kind of silly. And so it was sort of, it's a perfect encapsulation of sort of a, like a logical takedown of
the Gothic. Absolutely. Not unlike Harry Potter, right?
Right. Yeah. And I know B has talked some about how this parody of the Gothic, you know, is a connection that we see between Jane Austen and the Harry Potter work. And so let's turn to our wonderful guest today, who's going to tell us more about the many, many links that we can see between Jane Austen, who was, I guess, Rowling's, one of Rowling's very, very most favorite authors, and the Harry Potter series. So we are very delighted to have Dr. Beatrice Groves back with us on the show. Bea is a fellow and tutor at Trinity College, Oxford University, and author of the wonderful book, Literary Illusion in Harry Potter. She also writes for the MuggleNet blog, Batilda's Notebook. And there are all kinds of wonderful things that listeners, you will find if you will go to that site on MuggleNet. You can also find Bea on Twitter. Today, we're going to talk specifically with Bea about her work on Jane Austen and Harry Potter, which you can find in both Literary Illusion and Harry Potter. She has a whole chapter on that. You will not want to miss that. And also, she has a chapter in the recent anthology, Open at the Close. We, if you remember, Emily, we had editor Cecilia Conchar Farr of Open at the Close come to talk to us in episode 28, Literary Takes on Harry Potter. But today we're going to focus on the literary take that is telling us all about how Jane Austen and Harry Potter connect together. So it's so wonderful to have you on the show to talk about this today, Bea.
Hi, both. Thanks very much for inviting me. And yeah, I couldn't think of a better topic. I love talking about Jane Austen and Harry Potter.
Yeah, I mean, they're just both areas where I'm both kinds of books and writing that I can just get really jazzed about. So it's really fun. Well, what started you thinking about putting Harry Potter and Jane Austen together, thinking about the parallels?
Yeah, in fact, it's the beginning of my whole looking at Harry Potter is a Jane Austen link. So it's awesome. Mrs. Norris. Yeah. So I was reading Philosopher's Stone for the first time and I thought there's this evil cat called Mrs. Norris, and that's a Mansfield Park reference, and I've never come across a Mansfield Park reference in a children's book before, so I was like, this is quite surprising. So that's the whole thing that started me off looking at how she used literary illusion, because Mrs. Norris, it's not just the name, which is clearly, you know, a definite illusion because it's such an unusual name, but also she's like Mrs. Norris. And Mrs. Norris is always on the watch for other people failing. You know, she's delighted if anyone's not towing the line or not doing what they should be. Sort of, and exactly like the cat, who is kind of the familiar of Argus Filch, trying to find students out of bed or breaking the rules or making a mess. That's just absolutely how Mrs. Norris behaves. Mm-hmm. So I thought, yeah, it's such a nice, clever link. And I just thought, how lovely to put it in there. Just, you know, for me, I thought this is, she sort of put that in there for children to read it. And then when they get on to Mansfield Park, they'll go, oh, yeah, like the cat. Yeah.
Children and also me.
Well, sorry, not just children, but I sort of, yeah, who knows exactly. She always said, you know, I'm writing Harry Potter for me. And she wasn't particularly thinking of a children's audience. So could have gone either way. But I think there's lots of aspects of the first one. I think we've talked about this before, but, you know, when I first read it with a child, I thought those adverbs, which I totally understand people attacking her for as a point of style, but I was like, this is perfect for a new reader. My 6-year-old is looking for the adverbs to find out how he should read the line. Mm. You know, and adults don't need to do that. We can work that out, but children do still. It's still very helpful to have a reader, have an adverb telling you how you should speak it.
That is what Emily's chapter is about in Open at the Close.
There you go. It's a perfect segue through. Yeah.
Right. And I argue too, ultimately it doesn't matter and it does keep you reading. And although it's interesting that I noticed a lot of the same adverbs in her earlier Strike novels, but as they progress, I'm seeing some of that taper off, which I think is interesting. But that perhaps
that
is another episode.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because you think, I can see why that happens in Harry Potter because of the aging out of the audience. So she's expecting them to grow along with her, but maybe it's.
You still see, they still punctuate, they seem to punctuate the entire series, but yeah, with Strike maybe it's evolving a little bit. But B, in your open at the close essay, you said that Austin and Rowling both use the hero as a focalizing point for the narrative. Tell us about the protagonists of Rowling's books and Austin's books and what similarities they have to each other.
So one thing there is the narrative voice of both. So Austin uses this thing called third person limited omniscient view, which means that it sounds like it's omniscient. It sounds like you're getting the narrator's voice, but in fact, it's going through the Emma or Lizzie. You don't see things generally that character doesn't know, and that's the same with Harry. So it's a very good way both of getting the reader to identify with your hero and to spring surprises on them. So if Harry doesn't know something, the reader doesn't tend to know it either. So you sort of feel like you've got a universal view. So you don't realize that you're seeing things through Harry's partial perspective. And it's the same. So Emma, I think Emma is the novel which it's Rowling's favorite Austen novel. And I think it is the one that influences Harry Potter the most strongly. And definitely this sort of pulling the wool over the reader's eyes, as Rowling's put it, of both of them, that you sort of identify and you make the same mistakes. So the one would be, Snape would be the classic one with Harry, where he just keeps misreading Snape, and we're encouraged to do that along with her. And Emma is very, very clever. So Emma's, much cleverer than Harry's. Emma is the Hermione, but she keeps, despite being so clever, she habitually gets things wrong. And so I think for the in terms of the sort of link between characters, so Hermione and Emma have a strong link. Harry, interestingly, I think there are some Lizzie parallels, but by far and away the strongest one, I think, is Vanny in Mansfield Park. And then there's quite a lot of Catherine in Northanger Abbey as well. So it's interesting, I think, both that it's, he's identified with female characters, and that they are the most passive. So Fanny is Austin's. Austin has a mixture between Lizzie and Emma, who are dynamic heroes who make their own path, and then Fanny, who basically just stuff just happens to Fanny, and she puts up with it. And Catherine's not as passive, but she is an ingenue, so she's not understanding what's going on. So that ingenue image, where she's just. She goes to Bath and she's just delighted. And there's a lovely bit, she meets Henry and he's like, "Oh, well, you must get tired of Bath after 2 weeks. That's the fashionable thing." And she's like, Who could ever be tired of Bath? I just love it." And she's not embarrassed about her enthusiasm. And I feel that's how we have, with Harry and Hogwarts, he's just when he first goes into Diagon Alley and he wishes he had, more sets of eyes to see it all. So they share that ingenue enthusiasm, that innocence of heart. So definitely Catherine has that same, with the way in which Dumbledore talks about how the goodness of heart that Harry shows. And it's exactly the same. Tilney sort of falls in love with Catherine because she is so artless. And there's a lovely bit again, so where she sees his rakish brother ask Isabella Thorpe to dance, and she says, "Oh, well, he must have seen her sitting down and knew she wanted for a partner." And Henry Tilney says to her, that isn't how my brother thinks. My brother thinks there's a beautiful woman, I wish to dance with her." But the fact that you have imputed his wish to give her a dance to goodness of heart alone tells me that that's you. You are the one who has this goodness of heart, because you don't think about other people behaving in a way you wouldn't behave. So you're just imputing your own motives to him. And it's a very sort of charming bit. But I think that's the same with Harry and the Mirror of Erised, that it shows that his own impulses are entirely good. So I think he has both of those people. But I think the Fanny, so one of the strongest connections between the two novels, I think, is the fact that it's not their actual home that is their home. So Fanny is transported from Portsmouth to Mansfield, and it's the same kind of, it's just an extraordinary change from poverty to absolute glorious privilege place. And you know, that's her home. And she makes a mistake when she goes back to Portsmouth. She flies to home and then she thinks, oh no, I will really upset my parents. And they don't even notice because they care so little. They don't even notice she uses the word home to mean Mansfield. And it's exactly, of course, the same with Harry, where he says, you know, Hogwarts was his home. And when he goes home, that's going back to Hogwarts, not going back to Privet Drive. So this sort of Cinderella aspect of...
Right. And them. Yet this it's also being patrolled by Mrs. Norris.
There are. It's not like perfect, but there is a lovely bit where Mrs. Norris is banished. Do you remember at the end of Mansfield Park? So she chooses to go. She's not actually banished, but when Maria is banished, Mrs. Norris chooses to go with her. And then it says, you know, and now for Fanny, Mansfield's just completely perfect. So the ogre has gone. The only thing bad for her is Norris, and now she's chosen to leave. So that's, yeah. So she's now like, oh, it's just absolute perfection for her.
Yeah, Rowling doesn't get rid of the cat, though. She gotta revive the cat.
Little glimpse in Chamber of Secrets.
That's right. She's got to come back. Yeah, that's true. She doesn't have quite the same power, shall we say. But yeah, but obviously Rowling's happy with the idea that Hogwarts has these. You like Peeves, these parts of Hogwarts that are sort of more anarchic or negative.
Well, and of course, that when you think about Catherine Morland and her, you know, willingness to engage with the kind of mysterious gothic, to believe that there are these, you know, kind of darker forces out there, and that Harry goes along with some of that as well, right? And that's one of the things that actually turns out to be good for Harry, because while other people are like, no, these things don't happen anymore, kind of your Henry Tilney line.
Yeah.
This doesn't happen. And
there's a lovely, you know, one of the absolute, the sort of only verbal links other than Mrs. Norris's name between them is that Henry Tilney teases Catherine with what she'll find in Northanger and says, you know, are your nerves fit for what you might encounter in a place such as what one reads about, which is how she's described, you know, isn't it that the kind of place such as what one reads about might produce? You know, are you ready for sliding panel and hanging tapestry? And that line, sliding panel and tapestry, is when Harry first gets to Hogwarts, so the first trip to the common room, they go through sliding panels and tapestry. And when I read that, it's like, oh, I know that line. I know that line. That's in Northanger Abbey. And I love the fact that that's Tilney sort of saying to her what her gothic fantasies about this place will be. And it's not actually in reality going to be like that. But I feel like Rowling sort of said, well, what if it was like that? Let's imagine. So Hogwarts is, you know, is the way that Catherine imagines Northanger Abbey is going to be, not how it really is in the novel. There's this place of imagination.
Cool. Yeah, let's go back to Emma for a little bit. You talked a little bit about how, you know, the heroines of Emma and then Hermione are, you know, they're connected together as these protagonists that we, you know, we like them, but they're definitely not perfect. But you've also written about the parallels between the Riddle of the Sphinx in Goblet of Fire and the charade at the beginning of Emma. Why do both Rowling and Austin use riddles? And what's going on with that? I don't know. It's kind of like borrowing, right? More than just reference.
That's right. Yeah. So it's doing the same kind of thing. And I particularly noticed that one because the Riddle of the Sphinx, the normal Riddle of the Sphinx, is a conceptual riddle. So he says, you know, what's goes on? Four legs in the morning, two legs in the afternoon, and three legs in the evening. The answer is man. So you have to sort of work it out. And that's the way that the riddles of the Ravenclaw door work. You know, what came first, the phoenix or the flame? And you're like, this is a conceptual use. Whereas the riddle that the Sphinx tells in Harry Potter is a charade type riddle. You have to answer each one and you get a letter or a little part of a word, and then you mix them together and get another word. And that's how word games worked in Austen's life as well. So she used to play these kind of riddles and charades with her family all the time. So that's a nice aspect of that sort of social riddling, that Mr. Elton has given it to them to put in Harriet's riddle book, and she's collecting them all. But they are this type of riddle. So it's more like a it's sort of, you know, it's a different type of problem, so a bit less profound perhaps than
It's a
the.
little like a rebus, is that what they call them? Where you get like little parts of the word or the phrase, and then you have to put them together
Yeah,
through.
exactly. So a rebus can mean more than one thing. I mean, I think rebus is a very complicated word that means a number of things. One, it's an image as well, a rebus. So it can be a visual type one, but that's why Ian Rankin's detective is called Rebus, John Rebus. Sort of noticed that. That's giving him this crytalic name of a riddling solution name. Yes, it's very satisfying. So that charade at the beginning of Emma is a little plot in miniature where Mr. Elton is proposing to Emma via the charade, because the solution to the charade is courtship. And he's trying to find out if she's interested or not. And she immediately works out the charade, but she has no idea that this means that Mr. Elton is proposing to her. He thinks it means she's proposing to Harriet. And that's a little, you know, so she's sort of clever, but missed the point. And this is the sort of early one, and the big mystery in the novel is who's Frank Churchill in love with. And so Emma works out that Jane Fairfax has a secret lover, but she misses who it is. And the same, you know, she realizes Frank Churchill's in love with someone in Highbury, but she thinks it's herself and she gets the person wrong. So you get the little Mr. Elton charade-based riddle one trying to tell you, don't trust Emma's judgment on this. And then you have to try and not trust her judgment in the larger novel. She doesn't realize who she's in love with. She doesn't realize who Frank's in love with. She doesn't realize who Jane's in love with. So it's a very clever, Austen is making you fall for Emma, but she will also, you know, she's pointing out to you not to trust her. But you won't take the hint, almost certainly, and will not fail to do it. But, so it's a way of telling you about the fact that there will be a twist, I think.
Yeah, and
So it's a
it strikes me it's another one of those things that you get it when you reread it.
yes.
The benefit is in the rereading, which we know Rowling does that a lot too, and that those riddles and those little things that she plants, you only catch them when you're rereading.
Yeah. So it makes it, you know, I mean, I have you somebody said a phrase, you know, any book worth reading is worth rereading, and I really like that as a phrase. You know, there's stuff that you will only get the next time. It's, you know, it's a very confident thing as an author to put stuff in for the rereader. So you think,
Yeah, it
but yeah, I
is.
really like it. I really like it. And yeah, and Austen's absolutely like that. Everything is so spare with her that even if you read it 20 times, you think, I spotted another little thing that I didn't spot before. But I think so. In fact, I am hoping to so writing another book on Harry Potter at the moment, and it is going to be about Harry Potter's riddles.
Oh, wonderful.
So this is feels very opportune, and I think as well as telling you about the fact that there will be sort of twists, I think it is also sort of encouraging you in the sort of hermeneutic idea that is that there's something you know, that reading involves interpretation, and it's drawing your attention to the readerly act of interpretation that you normally don't notice you're doing, but when Emma reads the charade, she has to work it out. And the same with Harry in the Riddle of the Sphinx. And the same, you know, Rowling puts a riddle sort of right early on in Philosopher's Stone of sort of like the logic problems with the different so the potions and things. So just putting that right early on to tell you as a reader to be paying attention to the act of interpretation that you're doing.
Well, let's gossip for a second about gossip. Because you have suggested that Rowling and Austen are both interested in their works in revealing the pitfalls of gossip. Where do we see that?
An obvious place would be again Goblet of Fire. So Goblet of Fire, you know, is the pivot and novel in the middle, and loads of things that are important to the whole series appear in Goblet of Fire. And Goblet of Fire begins at the sort of Hanged Man with the gossip going on that's just got everything wrong. So the sort of gossip that just decides that because you know this Frank, you know, doesn't look like a good'un, that he must have murdered the Riddle family. And I feel like Austen too, she begins, so the sort of obviously one is the first lie. You know, it is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a large fortune must be in want of a wife. And that's that. It is a truth universally acknowledged. It's just a really good way of saying gossip. You know, everybody accepts this. This is the hive mind, and they're just wrong. You know, and she's just like, this is not. You know, what I'm interested in is individual truths between people, and both Lizzie and Mr. Darcy will, you know, be influenced by this hive mind and will need to free themselves from it to truly know what's real and what they genuinely feel for each other. So I really like the way she just sort of puts that. So there's loads of gossip goes on in Meryton, and you know, another thing is the ball, you know, where they all think this number of ladies is coming to the ball and this number of gentlemen. And you know, when he finally turns up, Mr. Bingley, he's just got his two sisters, not his five sisters, and one other, you know, and two other gentlemen. He's like, oh, we were expecting 15 people and all that sort of. So just this, just that, just a little telling you, don't trust them, you know, don't trust these the gossipy voices.
Yeah. And you said there's like a similar moment to that in Harry Potter where with the Yule Ball, right?
That's
Where
right. Yeah, exactly. So they're believing all these sort of, you know, 10 barrels of mead or something will be coming up from Roderick's murder and all this. Yeah. So there's a similar leading up to it, they're all sort of thinking, and you know, that these more exciting things will happen in the Yule Ball than will really happen. And I felt, yeah, it was a ball preparation feeling, and obviously preparing for a ball is important in a number of times in Austen. So it just sort of, yeah, the Yule Ball felt like an Austenian moment from that point of view. And of course we do find out, you know, there's some truths about the same way that at the balls you could kind of work out that Frank's in love with Jane and things like that, and Miss Knightley's in love with Emma. You know, it's that's the moment when, if you hadn't spotted that Ron and Hermione are going to end up together, then it's very, very clear there. But she's finally, Hermione has got it, and she's trying to tell Ron about what there's really going on, you know.
Yeah, and I was thinking too, like the school setting and, you know, small Regency town in England. Like there's something about those, you know, where you have this contained society. And of course, they're teenagers. So there's going to be all that kind of romantic stuff. And not just in four, but obviously, I think six is also a book where you see lots of, you know, relationship stuff
Oh
coming
yeah.
to the surface and rumors and, you know, who's seeing
And I
who
suppose,
and
yeah, so these emotional rumors, and obviously always getting these things where people are, you know, so two would be the main one, but where there's this rumor going around that Harry is this evil, you know,
oh, yeah.
internally powerful, evil, dark wizard. And lots of times when they're, you know, they're really, the community is really down on Harry. And you know, you have that sort of, how many times do you have to save the world before the other guys at your school think you're okay, you know?
You're until you're a trusted figure.
That's right. It's like a bit much, isn't it? Each time it happens again. But yeah, and I really, that's one of Fred and George's best moment, I think, where they go, you know, extremely evil wizard coming through, and it's like they think it's obviously patently ridiculous to think this about Harry, and you're like, yeah, they're completely right about that.
Yeah, and I mean schools are just like that. My kids come back with all kinds of rumors and I'm just like, I don't think so.
Yeah, it's true. They're rumor factories, aren't they? And I think that's right. This is sort of a modern, small, intense version of what the villages were. So at Meryton and things, everybody always knows when people are coming back, or you know, and the way in which, so poor Jane having this, that she's trying to conduct a relationship with Bingley against, you know, what the reason he goes the first time is just about the gossip. So Mr. Darcy overhears, you know, someone in marriage, who just thinks it's completely obvious that those two are going to get married. So he's like, obviously, Mr. Bingley's going to marry, propose to Jane. You know, he's like, what? I didn't know that. And that's why they separate, because Mr. Darcy hears the gossip. And it's very hard for Jane, you know, always having to deal with everyone else's expectations of what this will, you know, while trying to work out what she herself wants and what he wants. And, you know, they're not able to do it privately at all.
Right. Your chapter is called Communities of Interpretation in Jane Austen and Harry Potter. And I really like that phrase, communities of interpretation, that suggests that, you know, maybe a little differently from what you were talking about with the riddle of the Sphinx. That you have these communities that are collectively creating interpretation through gossip, which is as news, it has a kind of political value that ends up being, you know, really important in these communities, and that impels a variety of interpretations so that you know, you're the one who's broken the news, or you know what other people don't know.
Yeah, that's what I think I was trying to do there, which is perhaps similar to the riddle, is this difference between those that you trust and those that you don't trust. So the riddle interpretation is like in this small groups, you know, individually you have to work it out for yourself. You know, there's a nice bit in Deathly Hallows where Hermione says, you know, he can't just tell you, you have to work it out for yourself. And I feel that's the riddle. And I feel like that's the case with the communities of interpretation based on books in the novel. So I was talking about the way in which book lending and book giving, you know, Hermione always there to tell Ron and Harry what it says in Hogwarts history or whatever else. You know, she does the reading and she then shares the knowledge. Whereas then these larger communities interpretation where everyone just decides that Frank Bryce is a wrong'un or that Harry might be a dark wizard are not trustworthy.
Yeah. And one of the things that you talk about too is, I mean, and I think that you get this with, you know, the figures, and you've been talking about like especially Harry, but even a figure of notoriety, like or like a notorious figure, that gossip is kind of entwining with fame in a really interesting way. And is it ever a good thing, or are we being warned against the kind of, you know, fame that comes from being gossiped about?
Yeah, I feel strongly no, it's never a good thing that she's just warning you against. And I suppose Rita Skeeter would be the kind of embodiment of that. Rita Skeeter sometimes spots things that are true, but you know, everything she touches just turns to, you know, dust. It's just, I was remembering, it's very off topic, but it was just one of those, and I said, the way in which she turns what you say into something else, you know, and every time Harry says, she just interprets it. There was a radio show called Hancock's Half Hour in the 50s, and there's a bit where a journalist comes around to talk to him about a relationship, and he says something like, you know, I don't know what it was, like close in sisters or something. He says, oh, she was like that. And he says, no, it's just a figure of speech. And the journalist writes down, she had a figure like a and you think, I feel like Rita Skeeter, that's exactly
ran through the quick quote quill.
Yeah, that's what comes out. So I think, yes, definitely it's a not trusting that, and that Harry never gets any pleasure from his fame. You know, it's a thing that gets in the way.
Yeah, he does try to use it more successfully, right? Once they capture Rita, they capture the bug, you know,
it's very utilitarian of him, though. You know, I mean, I don't think he takes pleasure in using it.
No, you know? I think, and he's only having to try and get the true story out because a fake story has emerged, done the rounds. Yeah, so it's just trying to put that right. You know, that fake story wouldn't have happened if he hadn't been, you know, famous and problematic for the ministry. So I think, yeah, I feel that that's just a counteractive thing.
He even has thoughts occasionally. I think like when Malfoy breaks his nose and he gets left on the train, I think he even has thoughts of, oh, well, maybe everybody will wonder where the famous Harry Potter is. But then he immediately feels guilty about having that thought.
Yeah, and it's interesting, I think that's the only time. So I may be wrong by that, but I feel like he has that mum moment, and he hates it. The literal line is he hates himself for thinking that.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it is interesting. Obviously, and he is being watched, but he's not being watched because he's famous. He's being watched because Dumbledore is, you know, obviously he's central he's the hero. He's going to, you know, he needs to be looked after, kept safe to defeat Voldemort. So that's why Tonks is watching out for him there. So it's not a fame thing, but a heroism thing, which is
a security thing, really.
But the fame thing doesn't, you know, none of them do, you know, it doesn't get any sort of where's Harry Potter stuff going, although we do have plenty of people that does happen in other, you know, people are watching him and nudging and as he goes past and all that. Yeah,
you mentioned in the end of Pride and Prejudice, it's the gossip about Darcy and Elizabeth that spurs Lady Catherine de Bourgh's visit and her reaction to it. So is that kind of a way of turning gossip around?
Yes. So I think that is true. So definitely in Austen, she's sort of, as it were, purifying gossip by something, as it were, negative happening. And then their reaction to it is a positive one. And I felt, so I've linked that bit where Lady Catherine takes Lizzie out into the garden to tell her she's got to sort of publicly say this engagement isn't true. And that's kind of a crunch moment for Lizzie, where she does sort of, as it were, realise that she would really like to marry him. She's like, no, I'm not going to tell you this, and we're not engaged, but if we, you know, I would very much like to be engaged to him now I realize it. And I feel that parallels the bit where Scrimgeour comes to Harry in the same, takes him out of the house, into the garden,
right,
and says, you know, this is the case, and you know, so, and exactly the same, Harry refuses to go through with what's wanted by Scrimgeour, but it does make him think, you know, yeah, I am Dumbledore's man through and through, now you mention it. So he has been feeling very cross about Dumbledore, and the, you know, book five has been a sort of embittering, and I feel that's the sort of beginning of book six, sort of making him realize that, you know, and that, so that is a parallel, because Scrimgeour is reacting to gossip to an extent there, isn't he, of thinking, mm-hmm. you're the chosen one. He doesn't know that that's really the case, or that that's what the prophecy said. He just sort of, that's the gossip.
Yeah, and he wants him to be like a spokesperson. He only wants him to serve in a almost a kind of gossipy, you know,
yeah,
a
mascot, you know, basically. Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. And Harry won't do that, but it does, that affects a positive understanding of his own sort of heart from him.
Well, I loved a lot of what you had to say about reading in both your chapters, your chapter in Literary Illusion and in Open at the Close. Especially as portrayed in Potter and in Austen's novels, how does reading create community?
Well, so I think this is one of the sort of, I suppose, an underlying aspect of what I'm trying to do in Literary Illusion and Harry Potter, is to talk about the way in which reading creates a community on its own, that the reader and the author are in dialogue when they read. And so when you see an illusion, you see a writer as a reader. So you're recognizing them as, like you, someone who reads. So it has a lovely, yeah, sort of you, them. And so with, you know, Fenton Austin, you've seen Rowling and Austin and yourself sort of all together. And I think, you know, there's a famous line from a Renaissance scholar, Stephen Greenblatt, where he says, "I began with the desire to speak with the dead." And he says that's why he got into reading. Yeah. And I do feel that. Yeah.
Yeah. This is like a little sidelight, but this is one of the things that bothers me so much about artificial intelligence writing, because I feel like there is something, you know, that's just fundamentally almost sacred about the way that writing connects you with another human being.
It's a bit like a zombie, isn't it? I think AI, you're just like, this is a fake.
Maybe, yeah, like a Frankenstein.
Yeah,
like
exactly. A Horcrux. It's like creating something alive out of something that's dead. You're like, no, absolutely. No, I...
And AI writing feels dead to me in that same way, right? You don't, you can, when you, you know, and the students have started using it, and so I've seen some AI.
And I know what this is. Yeah,
one of the tip-offs is, and a lot of students, they're not sophisticated enough readers to be able to know this themselves. But you know, you when you read it, you can feel that it's like maybe not a person behind that, because it does feel lifeless in a way that, you know, even not great student writing usually has life in it.
There's a mind behind it. No, I completely agree. And of course, it is entirely parasitic. It can only do this because so many people have put their own writing out into the internet and the world. You know, if it didn't exist, then it would be powerless. So
And so I think your argument about books providing communities of interpretation, it just really spoke to me in this particular context of thinking about, you know, the AI writing world, you know, because it's like you say, it's, you know, one person speaking to another, and even the author, I love this idea that the author is also speaking to the reader as a fellow reader.
Yeah,
you know?
it has a lovely balancing out the power, doesn't it? I start that piece with a quote from Proust, which I like so much. So I'm going to just read it out here. But he says that reading is a fertile miracle of a communication effected in solitude. It enables us to receive the communication of another's thought while still being on our own, to be open to inspiration with our minds still at work hard and fruitfully on themselves. And I think that's so beautiful, because it's sort of, it's saying you're not, like, it's another person's voice, but they can't interrupt you. So you're still entirely in charge. I think that's sort of Proustian. I think he quite likes being in control. But I think even without that, it has a lovely sense of a communication that's still, still ongoing, but somehow the reader's in charge, even though the writer has done all the work. So it has this very interesting balance.
Well, it seems more dialogic in that way, a dialogue between reader and writer, not just a passive, you know, acceptance of what's on the page.
Absolutely. And this is, you know, so writers will always make this point about film, that there is something, you know, film has been created by somebody else and is put in front of you. And a book is not like that. You do the thing that you, you know, in you're at Hogwarts, you are somewhere you have also created in your imagination. It hasn't been created by the author, but it's been created by you as well. And you meet in a sort of intermediate space, which is created by both of you.
Yeah. And one of the things that I also really like about that too, is that you can find that you are connected. And of course the Harry Potter realm is filled with this, but also the Austenian realm, that, you know, by reading the same things, you are connected with other people who have also read those things. And sometimes you may have, you know, a different mental picture of Hermione, for example. But there are things that you're going to share, and you have now a kind of community because you've read some similar things, and you have, you know, something to be going on about in your relationship.
And that is something, obviously, that, you know, modernity with obviously, you know, fandom for the carp and book clubs and things, that we're sort of, really enjoying this aspect of communities created by reading the same things. And it works through time as well, you know. If you read Montaigne's essays and he's been reading the classics, and then you might also read the classics, so you can read, you know, you have that sort of connection with Montaigne, who's, you know, 400 and whatever years ago, but it's still, you feel actually we've both been reading the same things. Yes, very
I've
powerful.
Actually written, I've written a little bit about reading as time travel. You know, I'm interested in that as a historian who loves literature. So I think it is I absolutely agree. It connects across space and time, and it forges these kinds of communities. And I love how, you know, in the Harry Potter books, like I often feel Hermione is looking for that. Like, am I the only one who's read Hogwarts of History? Where are my peeps? Where are my people on this? But that, you know, when you have that, and of course the whole thing in Deathly Hallows is solved by the story that is a commonly known community story that is passed down through generations from Beedle the Bard.
And we get this lovely thing of, you know, just that little insight into Ron's childhood of Mrs. Weasley telling him this story. And that's one of those little moments where you think, you know, the poverty of Harry's child is not just that he didn't have Beedle the Bard, you know, he didn't have anyone telling him fairy tales at bedtime, and the richness of Ron's past. So you get that sense of all the time that's passed by the fact that you know, the whole idea of oral transmission of story being present there, and the little change from the time of day at which that story is taking place is a way that's passed through generations. I think that's so clever of her to just give a genuine oral transmission history to a story she's just made up. It's a wonderful little insight into the way stories pass down.
Yeah. So when we think about, you know, the reading and the importance of books, and of course that both Harry Potter and the Jane Austen novels, we can see that. And I mean, Catherine Morland loves, you know, Gothic novels.
And she gets together to read them with Isabella Thorpe. Now, unfortunately, that's not a great friendship, but they get together to read books in the same room, which we think probably most people who do that now probably think that's quite a modern idea, to meet up with a friend and read at the same time, but no.
Right. Yeah. And of course, I mean, libraries also are these important spaces. And when you know, you've talked a little bit about the importance of book filled spaces in both the Wizarding World and in the Regency English setting of Jane Austen's novels. Given that, you know, the importance of books and like libraries and bookstores and all of that, what do you think about how the Hogwarts library is portrayed and Madame Pince? And why is she a more positive character?
She's amusingly negative. I love that. Right. The foul bit where she starts chasing them. We used to have in my school library, they had an image of sort of a medieval woodcut of someone whacking someone else over the head. And it said, this will be your punishment if you remove a book wittingly or un.
Which oh,
the
my
first
gosh.
Time I never come across that.
Wow.
And it was a very, whenever I see Mrs. Pinson, I think of that. Like, yes, Madame Pinson in my head. Teacher. Yeah, I mean, Rowling has said it's part of the fact of the power of the Hogwarts library, you know, the answers are all there, that if you had a helpful librarian,
the story would be too easy.
Yeah, exactly. It'd be too easy. So they can't have someone they could just go and say, tell us about Nicholas Flamel, you know. And I like that as a solution. So she's like the dragon in charge of the gold hoard, that you have to, yeah, you have to get through her. She can't be helpful. Nice.
Yeah,
she
has there's the whole restricted section. I mean, there are parts of the library that exist, and yet the students can't get to them. Yeah, because yeah. She's a gatekeeper.
Not without permission. Yeah, right. I don't know. I'm thinking of her all anew now because, you know, she is so severe out of protection of the books.
Mm.
And so that whole idea that she is so unpleasant is maybe turned on its head a little bit when you think about the reason for her unpleasantness is solely the protection of the books, which were meant to interpret as marking good spaces. You know, positive spaces. So I'm kind of thinking
absolutely.
Of her new. Yeah,
absolutely. And she feels, you know, that the students are not respecting their books enough, and they must therefore be kept. this is only worth it. You know, you're only allowed here if you really.
Right. Exactly. Maybe she should stop listening to gossip about students. Maybe that's part of the problem. But you know who else I thought of, or whose space I thought of, when you were kind of pointing out these examples of how these book filled spaces. Show us the good spaces in Harry Potter is Snape's home, you know,
absolutely.
And what
absolutely,
a clue that is, that his every wall was filled with books.
Yes.
And that even though he's doing something that seems really bad in this scene, we're surrounded by books as he does it.
Yeah, that point was made by David Martin in his piece on the role of books, which can be found at Hogwarts Professor, which he did as a MistyCon talk in 2013, where he goes through all the books in the series, and it's brilliant. And that I felt that was his biggest find. There was the was the book lined room of Snape being an excellent clue of telling you which side he's on.
Well, I'm glad my brain is
exactly.
aligned with David Martin's, because what better brain to be aligned with? Okay, so how does Gilderoy Lockhart, who produced a slew of books, perhaps filled with lies, they're not exactly a force for good, these books in the Harry Potter series, they're maybe even more sort of in line with gossip. So how does Gilderoy and his books fit into your thesis about gossip and reading in the series?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. And I think, you know, one can't help reading it sort of slightly biographically, of sort of putting the aspects that one doesn't like of, you know, authorial sort of arrogance and confidence, sort of putting it onto a character and then separating yourself from that. So I think he definitely has that sort of, this is the danger of where books can go wrong, where too much belief in these things. So I think it's the sense that you still, you know, just, you know, just as with Rita Skeeter, just because something's published doesn't mean it's true. Mm-hmm. You still have to keep your own integrity and your own sort of critical faculties. And Hermione, you know, for once lets her guard down and sort of falls for him a bit, and to sense that that's, you know, you still have to keep that going. Now, a lot of the stuff he says, of course, is true. It's just, it's not him. So he's taking, you know, real things right. from other people and stealing it. So it's like you're saying with AI, he's like an original AI chatbot of stealing other people's stuff. So when you read the book, the stuff is true. This might well work as a way to get rid of the waggle waggle werewolf, whatever, because it did. Someone really did this, but it's just he's lying. So it's he's an interesting one, I think.
I love that idea that he's a chatbot.
He's a very human, yeah,
very charming chatbot, though.
Well, until, you know, he's willing to kill them basically at the end, isn't it? You're like, this is quite an extreme, you know. He seems sort of just, you know, charming until then when it's quite funny. But he's like, what a moment, you were going to just
This is what happens when the machines take over.
Yes, they seem charming. You were warned, Gilderoy Lockhart.
Yeah, and of course, Hermione learns a lot from being disillusioned by Gilderoy Lockhart, and she becomes such a better reader over the whole course of the book series that that's what allows her to be a good interpreter in the last book.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I feel like we, you know, I think Hermione is the one who grows the most in many ways. Obviously, Harry's meant to, you know, he begins braver, but basically, you know, he's got that sort of purity of heart completely in the first book when the Mirror of Error said that's all, you know, he's got it already. Whereas Hermione, I think she's the one who grows the most. And I love the change, for example, with Neville, where in the, you know, the first thing we see is Hermione being kind to Neville. She's trying to find his toad, but it's this sort of bossy kindness. She's just sort of, you know, she's taken over and she's doing the right thing, but she's not doing it in a very appealing way. Mm-hmm. And in Goblet of Fire, when Moody is, you know, psychologically torturing Neville by doing the Cruciatus curse in front of him, and intentionally so, I think, Hermione doesn't know what's going on, but she immediately sees Neville's distress and intervenes, and, you know, stands up to a teacher and says, stop.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a very strong thing for her to do, particularly with this, you know, new, charismatic, rather scary teacher.
Yeah.
To tell him off and tell him, you've got to stop that. I think it's very brave of her, and that sort of, you know, this new care for Neville, which, as I said at the beginning, is, you know, is a bit overbearing, and she does kind of, you know, do the full body bind curse on him and stuff.
Yeah.
You know? And, but well, by four, she's really looking out for him.
And you connect Hermione to Emma in that way, right? That there's this slightly condescending, you know,
yeah, exactly.
She sort of has
bossy,
at the beginning.
Bossy friendship, that, right?
Yeah.
I'm trying to learn about real friendship. And I kind of, I enjoyed that connection, a very different connection, but I felt like another cat connection, that Crookshanks is like the Harriet Smith of the series, in that Ron, just like Mr. Knightley, cannot see why Emma is completely obsessed with Harriet Smith, and Ron just cannot see why Hermione just completely sort of falls for Crookshanks in this slightly surprising way. But of course, Hermione's kind of right about Crookshanks, so that's quite nice. So unlike, you know, Austin is sort of telling Emma off with the relationship with Harriet, and she is a bad friend to her, and she isn't, you know, approaching friendship in the right way. She's not, you know, instead of having a friendship with someone who's her equal, she's choosing someone beneath her who she can kind of patronize. Actually, it's nice that Hermione's quite right about Crookshanks, and Crookshanks is on the, he's very clever and he knows what's going on.
Yeah, so you actually connect Crookshanks's name to a like famous like cartoonist satirist, Crookshanks.
Yes, that's right.
From the same time period, and you see, you know, with the claws and the teeth and being able to see through in a way that, you know, the satirist often can.
Exactly. So. And I like the sort of move. People often talk about biting satire.
Yeah.
And I feel like with Crookshanks, that's literal. You know, he's scratching and biting, and because he sees what's really going on, you know, you think,
yeah,
Ron just thinks he's being and Hermione just thinks he's being a cat who's attacking a rat, but actually, no, he's seeing through. And that's obviously what good satire does, is incredibly aggressive, but aggressive in the service of the truth and revealing the truth to you.
Yeah. And as somebody who has definitely loved a perhaps hard to love cat, I have to say,
amen.
I totally understand.
Amen.
And, you know, people are like, why are you in this
what
cat?
This
and it's
cat?
Like,
yeah.
She's my baby. Leave her alone.
I have a codependent relationship with my cat, for sure.
Yeah, and I think it's a sign of character to love the hard to love cat.
Right.
It's funny. Again, this is a biographical thing from Rowling. So Rowling's not a cat person. She's definitely a dog person.
Mm-hmm.
You get it. Although McGonagall is a cool cat, isn't she? So there is a, you know, there is a
that's true.
Cat mm-hmm. as well as these. But Crookshanks is based on a cat that used to visit her when she was sort of, when she would eat her lunch when she was working for Amnesty International in London.
Oh.
And this sort of slightly, I think probably similar looking, sort of slightly squashed faced, bow-legged ginger cat.
Yeah.
And she just liked it. She just felt this one had character. And she took to that cat. So Crookshanks is based on a cat that got through
and a slight criminal attitude. I do enjoy that in the cat as well. And, you know, just to my point, I mean, I have to say, I think one of the things that humanizes Filch is he loves his cat. We're back to yes. Mrs. Norris.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like that's actually, I totally think that is Filch's probably best quality.
It is his best quality. And I really like the bit where Harry, you know, actually feels sorry for him. Mm-hmm. I mean, not half as sorry as he felt for himself, if everyone believed that he'd done it, you know. But right. He does have a little moment of thinking, you know, yeah, he does love his cat. Yeah, no, I agree with you. And Rowling has spoken about that as the most familiar type relationship. So this sort of, she does, you know, they do all have these animals that come with us. The Scabbers, you know, turns out to be a human, and we have Neville and his toad, and so we have these sort of, and Harry and Hedwig, these sort of quite witchy type relationships with a specific animal, but actually the human who's closest to an animal is Filch and Mrs. Mm-hmm. Norris. They have a sort of telepathic relationship. You know, it's a bit like Fawkes and Dumbledore, who sort of, you do simply mm-hmm. have a sort of almost telepathic relationship. But it's fun that she gives to the, you know, the squib the actual really traditional witchy relationship.
Oh yeah, that's neat. Well, B, you have also stumbled upon some interesting parallels between the life of Jane Austen and one of Rowling's character backstories on the Wizarding World Archive. Please fill us in. Where do we see some glimpses of this? Who's the character?
So this is it's McGargle. So we were just talking about her, and the witch. So that works rather well. And in fact, this works very well with gossip as well, because it's something that Austen's biographers love to gossip about. You know, she doesn't have a very gossipy life, Austen, so they often have to work quite hard. And Deirdre LeFay, who is the editor of Austen's letters, is admirably free from gossip. I'm very impressed by her. So she just has a little note where she says that Harris Bigwither, who does not sound like a very prepossessing name, I think people often think less of him for the name, but anyway, he proposed marriage to Jane Austen on December 1802, and Deirdre LeFay just writes, Jane Austen accepted Harris one evening, only to withdraw her consent the next morning. And that's all she says. And I was like, that is, you know, the least gossipy you can imagine.
That's
but if you read,
that's what we know.
If you read, you know, imagine other biographers go in a bit more and imagine a you know, stormy night and wondering if it's going to infect her authorship, and she's going to be, you know, one of the blank horror. One of them says, you know, that night was one of the most terrible of Jane Austen's life. She was forced to contemplate with blank horror the stupidity of what she's done. And
oh,
bitter though it was, she must acknowledge her error and confess her mistake. And he's like, what? You don't know anything. That's all you know.
That's a fanfic. That's a Catherine Moreland approach.
It is.
To,
you know,
right. This right. little we've snippet.
We've got to milk this. But I felt when I was reading in Pottermore, where Rowling creates a number of backstories for characters, and one of them is McGonagall, she has a very brief engagement in her backstory. And this is what she writes. All that night she lay awake thinking about her future. It would be the end of her ambitions. It would mean one locked away. Early next morning, Winona slipped from her parents' house and went to tell Dougal that she changed her mind and could not marry him. Mindful of the fact she broke the international statute of secrecy, she would lose her job at the ministry for which she was giving him up. She could give him no reason for her change of heart. So both cases, we've got a broken engagement after one sleepless night rethinking the decision, and then neither woman ever marries for the rest of their life. And it does seem likely, I'd say, that Austen might have been thinking about her authorial future in terms of, as a married woman, would she be free to write in the way that her family had enabled, you know, who knows what her husband might think about this. And that's obviously why McGonagall is doing so, you know, wand locked away. She would not be able to pursue her career if she married a muggle. And there is a sort of specific link between wands and pens. So Rowling, there's a number of times links between writing, reading and magic in Rowling, and she has sometimes talked about her, you know, her pen, her magic wand. So I felt that, you know, the wand locked away did feel a bit like the Austen not being able to write. So yeah, there you are. I thought, oh, that's fun. And I know, you know, that Deirdre LeFay edition of Austen's letters is on Rowling's bookshelf. You can see it on the
Ah.
bookshelf. So there was a bookshelf photo taken for the adult version of Deathly Hallows in the English edition. It's on the back of Deathly Hallows. And so I've spent many a happy hour trying to work out what the books are. But the ones I myself own are the ones that jumps out. So that one's like, oh, I know that one. That's Austin's Letters because I have that one.
Yeah.
But the ones I ha don't own are much more difficult to identify. But yeah, so I know she does, she has it. So if she's read it, she'll know about that broken engagement. And I wondered if that was behind. And I also quite like it because McGonagall is named after an author. So she's named her after this terrible author because she thought it's really funny to have such a brilliant woman named after, you know, the worst poet who's ever existed. But I quite liked giving her a rather better authorial link through this biographical story.
Yeah, and I love how your detective work there is just confirming everything that we've said about communities of interpretation and how when you read the same books, it creates
Yes,
this
right.
connection.
You go, aha, I know where you got this one.
Yeah. Yeah, well, cool.
There was one thing I wanted to say, and I don't think I've ever written about this because I can't quite find the right words for it. And I have sort of asked, so I don't work on prose usually, so I'm much more interested in drama and poetry. I don't have a name for this, but when I've tried to ask other academics who work on prose, they've sort of said, oh yeah, I don't know a name for that. So it's difficult to write about, but to talk about, it's a sort of version of objective correlative, and it's a kind of version of proleptic parody, which means a parody where the parodic things happens first. And objective correlative is where a physical thing symbolizes something like emotional or non-physical. But this is a plot device. So both of them use objective correlative as a plot device, which I think is very unusual. And I would be really interested if other people have got other examples. But the most famous example in Mansfield Park is climbing through the gate. So Maria wants to go a particular way, and Mr. Rushworth, who she's engaged to, doesn't have a key to the gate. So she makes him go back to the house and find the key. And while he's gone, Mr. Crawford says, well, you know, you could just climb over. Why need to wait for the key? Why wait for permission? You could just climb over. And so she does. And Fanny's like, no, this isn't a good idea. And Fanny gets very, very stressed about it. And the reason Fanny gets stressed about it, we realize sort of later, is because this is an objective correlative and a proleptic parody of the fact that Maria will get out of her marriage and have an affair with Mr. Crawford. So this
Oh.
climbing, instead of going through the gate in the lawful way with the key with her husband, she's going to be climbing over the gate with her lover. And Austen does it a number of times. So there's another really nice one in Mansfield Park where Mr. Crawford, who wants to marry Fanny, buys her a chain to hang the cross that her brother, who she loves, has given her. And then Edmund, who's the person she actually wants to marry, also buys her a chain for this cross. And it's really awkward because everyone expects her to wear Mr. Crawford's chain, but she wants to wear Edmund's, and so she's stuck about what is she going to do. And then she tries it and discovers Mr. Crawford's chain won't fit through the glass. So she's like, yes, I get to wear it. And Edmund's fits perfectly. And that's again the sort of she's not going to have to marry Mr. Crawford. She will get to marry Edmund. It's told to you by the way in which the chain won't fit through her cross. There's another one in Emma where when Emma thinks that Harriet is going to, or Miss Knightley might propose to Harriet, and she sees Mr. Knightley and Harriet walking down a path together, but then it turns out that it's a fake path and it doesn't have an ending and it's just blocked off and they have to come back. So again, that sort of sense that's an abortive relationship. It's never going to happen. She doesn't need to worry about it. So there's loads, you know, I think those are three, really interesting examples, and they're never, it's never pointed out to you this is going on. So it's again one of those things you say about the reread. And there's a few places where it happens in Rowling. And one is that when Hermione is wondering how Rita knows, how does she know what's going on, how she's overheard this conversation, she's pounding up a beetle in her pestle and mortar. So you're like, that's the clue, the clue's there. And there's another very similar one where in a charms lesson, they're trying to work out, you know, what's going on with something that's going on with Snape. And again, they make guesses. And when they make correct guesses, the cushion they're trying to land in the box lands in the box. And when they make the wrong guesses, it flies out and doesn't land in the box.
cool.
So I wonder if that's, again, just, I wouldn't think that something, it's not an illusion or anything, but I wonder if it's a narrative technique mm-hmm. that Rowling has unconsciously learnt from Austen, because I don't think it's at all common. You have to be, you know, a very clever writer and interested in leaving these kind of clues mm-hmm. that are never explained. And Austen and Rowling are both like that, but I think it's quite uncommon. And anyway, I would love if anyone, you know, spots any others. I'm always interested in finding out, or indeed knows what you should call it.
Yeah, I guess I've just I'm listening and thinking, well, it just seems like a really heavy layers of symbolism that accompany the narrative. But I'm sure there's a more
precise term for it. Well, I just feel like it's a physical thing.
Yeah, it's
symbolism is not always, you know,
right.
Obviously it is symbolism, but I just feel it's a very specific form where a physical thing in the narrative tells you something about the plot.
Points to a larger truth. Yeah, you know, I would probably call it sacramental, because that is what, you know, sacraments, there are these signs, but I mean, they're more specific signs of the divine presence that show forth and point to something larger in the narrative. So it's almost got that quality to it, but not necessarily with the God content, the divine, you know, content. But because I'm thinking of like, on Christmas, in I think the first book, the Weasley twins are outside throwing snowballs at the back of Quirrell's turban.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, I wonder, I mean, that doesn't, there's not, it's not accompanying the revelation of who that is, but it's a huge clue.
No.
I
think that fits exactly.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
It's exactly right. And there's a lovely parallel to that, which is that Ron vomits slugs up on Tom Riddle's name.
Wow.
Do you remember that? So that's why he remembers it. Yeah, and it's why, like, the Weasleys have a natural affinity to goodness, that they are, you mm-hmm. know, they attack Voldemort in these different forms, even though they don't know that's who he is. I really like that.
Right, right.
But yeah, I agree. I certainly think that's another version of it.
Well, and I mean, I think you could even consider the interpretations that I have done and Caitlin Harper has done of Quidditch as functioning in a very similar way, as a symbol set that really points to these truths of the larger narrative and of characters' roles within the larger narrative and mm-hmm. what they're meant to do and what they can expect from the fight, you know, that it's not fair, that there's two separate realms of battle going on, Harry and the Horcruxes and then everybody else against the Death Eaters, you know? So I feel like that all fits in that same category. And you're right. There's something very specific about that symbolism just doesn't cover.
Exactly.
But I wish you well in figuring out how to.
Invent a term.
And yeah. I think it might be an inventor. I had to do this recently with a bibliographical thing, which is that, so there's a, you know, the page header, so there's a line at the top of a page printed, so you don't really get these in modern books that much, but you get that where the, so for example, in Open at the Close, you have the name of the author or the name of the article at the top of the page, and that's called the page header. But if you read an early modern Bible, so like the Geneva Bible, they have two columns of text, and they change, they tell you exactly what's happening, so there are two different page headers per page. So it's like, we can't just call those page headers, so I've called them hot column headers, so nothing wild, but I don't think there is a bibliographical term for that. So it's one of those I sort of thought, is it just I don't know it and I could just find a bibliographical term who can tell me, but I haven't been able to find one, and I have asked them before, so I have invented the term column header. So there we go.
I thought of the term, I mean, signum, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like it's a sign, you know, like it's almost like, I mean, I'm trying to work off of my understanding of sacramentality, but to kind of absent the religious content from it, you know? So some kind of, I feel like the term sign, you know, might factor in to a definition of that at some point.
You just want to make sure it has that tangible element that B's talking about too.
That's the problem, is that objective correlative is already such a long phrase.
Yes.
So what I would want is, like, you know, sign correlative or something, but it's like, you know, it's already, objective correlative is already too long to be able to just add another word to it without getting a bit out of hand. But anyway,
cool.
yeah.
I love this conversation. We're breaking literary boundaries today.
We are. We're pioneering. We're boldly going.
Pioneering podiversity.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Bea, for joining us on the show today and giving us all this really cool information and like suggestive interpretation about the ways that Harry Potter and Jane Austen novels connect together. Thanks so much, Bea.
Thanks so much for inviting me. And it's really nice to, as I say, is the thing that sort of started off the whole, the only reason I'm in Harry Potter fandom at all is due to Mrs. Norris. So there we go.
Oh, cool. I love that. Remember, listeners, that you can read more about this in Bea's book, Literary Illusion in Harry Potter, and also Bea's chapter in Open at the Close, which is titled Communities of Interpretation in Jane Austen and Harry Potter. You can also, of course, find Bea at her blog, Batilda's Notebook, on MuggleNet and on Twitter. Today, we are going to close with a quote from Ron Weasley about the enchantment of books, a quote that I think speaks to both Bath's famous resident, Jane Austen, and the Harry Potter series. In the Chamber of Secrets, Ron tells Harry, "Some of the books the Ministry's confiscated, Dad's told me. There was one that burned your eyes out, and everyone who read Sonnets of a Sorcerer spoke in limericks for the rest of their lives. And some old witch in Bath had a book that you could never stop reading. You just had to wander around with your nose in it, trying to do everything one-handed." That sounds about right to me.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburnd, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburnd. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.